Si je fais ça, est-ce que ça marche? So, hello everyone. Good afternoon. It's afternoon now. It's not afternoon in Portugal, I know, but very happy to be here and to have everyone here, people we haven't seen for a long time. It's wonderful that coming back together in person brings us really back together. It's great. And so we came into this space today, which we know because we sit here on Thursday nights, but it's a completely different experience to be here on a Saturday. And unexpected events occurred. And we just responded to whatever arose, which is what our practice is anyway. But this is really the beauty of the way that we have decided to practice Wildflower, is really direct experience of responding to situations, whatever it is. And situations change, things change all the time. During this 20 minutes of sitting, there was this amazing, absolutely sublime spectacle of shadow and light on the floor. I don't know who else, others were observing it as well. Absolutely spectacular. Clearly there were many clouds passing, and which meant that on the floor, this constant change of shadow and light. Sometimes there was no sign of the sun. Of course, obviously there is, but and then when the cloud would go away, the shadow and light was extreme, and there were these rectangles of light with defined by the shadow. And it became so, well, it became very clear that we see light because of shadow, and we see shadow because of light. That contrast is absolutely essential, and that in the darkness we don't see either. We don't see really the darkness, and we don't see really the light, because we need one to define the other, right? And it was impermanent. It was coming and going. It was really just beautiful. Almost like, neon flashing lights or something. It had that kind of quality of, which is artificial, but which had that quality of just coming and going, and we didn't know when it would come or go or be there or not. And that's a perfect metaphor for what our life is at every moment. We just don't know. We don't know what cloud will emerge and what cloud will fly past. So we arrived here today. We didn't know. We had some ideas about maybe what it would be, but of course it's not at all what we thought. We have this little box in which we keep our things, so we can ring bells and clap and have little books that we can chant with, and a picture of the Buddha that we can put on an altar. And because we can't have candles or incense, we have this little candle that we just turn on, and it's light. And yet, that is absolutely the altar. We didn't even know what we would use for an altar. We looked around, and so Daniel jokingly said, "Well, I can be the altar, and that would be the ultimate devotion, right? To be the altar, kind of bend over and be the altar on which we put the things. And I said, well, you are the altar. We all are the altar already. And yet, because we, or no, not and yet because, but so let's back up and say, so we decide that the altar is something sacred. And we designate a place, an object, objects that we put on it that are sacred. But as we, and then we eliminate what is not that, and we say the rest is not sacred, right? And we do that with ourselves too. So when I say you all the are, you all the are, you are the altar, you are sacred. We don't see this usually, or we see, think that we are sacred, but the others are not, or certain others are not, or certain places are sacred, or certain objects are sacred. And then we eliminate everything else. But as we see today, so we are sitting in this room that is used by a physical therapist. In Lisbon, they are sitting in Krisha's living room. João looks like he's maybe in his kitchen, and Michael, I don't know, probably in his office or something, and Carla in her living room as well. So, and but that is sacred ground. Where each of us is sitting is sacred ground. In French, we say the terre d'éveil. This is the ground of awakening wherever you are. It can't be anywhere else. And if we truly see that, if we listen to Bodhidharma's famous words to the emperor, vast emptiness, nothing sacred, the key is, so the vast emptiness, that means that there's no distinctions. So it's like when, like right now, the sun is behind the clouds, so there's no, we don't see those rectangles of light or the shadow that's, the bars of its shadow. That's the vast emptiness, no distinctions. And in those, so that, therefore, that means that we're not saying this is sacred and that's not sacred, which is another way of saying that everything is sacred. He says nothing sacred because the person he's saying that to believes very strongly that there are some things that are sacred. He believes that, so the emperor in that case believes that everything he's doing to support the Buddhist practice, the beautiful statues, the temples, everything that he is financing with his sacred resources, to set it apart from outside is sacred. And so Bodhidharma is saying to him, nothing is sacred. If the emperor had been presenting him, there's nothing sacred. We can do whatever we want. I don't care. We can destroy temples. We can destroy people's homes. We can destroy, we can build homes on your land. We can take away your water. I can ride my bike wherever I want to on the sidewalk. I can drive the car however I want. If the emperor were presenting that, it would have been appropriate for Bodhidharma to say everything is sacred. But because Bodhidharma, because the emperor was fixed on an idea that some things are sacred, Bodhidharma tells him nothing is sacred. And usually our position in the world is that we have an idea about what is sacred and what's not. However we want to define sacred. We could say special, we could say, worthy of respect, worthy of veneration, worthy of attention. So if we switch it around and say everything is sacred, that means everything is worthy of respect. Everything is worthy of our attention. Everything and everyone. There's not something that is we can pay attention to and other things we don't have to pay attention to. Now, of course, I know how, you know, the wheels of the mind are going and saying, okay, well then how can we function in the world? Yeah. But the fact is, if we say everything is worthy of attention, then we pay attention to what is right here. Whatever presents itself. One thing is not more worthy than another. At this moment, this is what I need to give my attention to, because this is what is here. At another moment, I have to give my attention to something else. When the sun, when the cloud goes in front of the sun, well, now I see that it's moved, so the rectangles of light are back there instead of here. So obviously the sun has moved. But this is as worthy of my attention, the floor, as it was when I was fascinated by the shadow and light, the dance of shadow and light. You know, we can maybe ask ourselves, well, where do I draw the line for what is worthy of attention and what is not? I re-saw this the other night. I re-saw that short documentary about Ram Dass. I don't know if people have, it was out a few years ago and people were talking about it then. And so I was with someone who wanted to watch it, so we watched it again. And he, you know, his thing is, or his thing was, because he's since died, was just, it was really, you are loving awareness. That was the thing he just said over and over again. If you can just sit with loving awareness, and just repeat this like a mantra, loving awareness, loving awareness, loving awareness. His experience was that you become that then. You and all of the separations fall away, and you are aware of just this. That's another way of saying attentive to, you know? And when that happens, when you truly give your full attention to whatever is, well, then there's only love. There's nothing to not love. It doesn't mean we like it, you know? Immediately, then we think, well, then I can't love war. I can't love hate. I can't love starvation. I can't love cancer that someone is suffering from or something. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that we have to like it and want it to be happening. It means that we recognize it as something sacred. That, let's see, how could we say this? There's this trend in the United States, and I know in Australia as well, and Canada, of returning to the native names of places and lakes and cities and rivers and things, even the names of the land. So this is which is an interesting touching effort to recognize before you arrived here, this is what this place was. So especially in Australia and in North America, Same thing is true in South America, although there seems to be more contact with the indigenous people in South America. I don't know. And so it's strange for me when I go back to my where I grew up, and I knew the name of a lake as being something. And now everyone calls it something else, a name that I can't even pronounce, right? But it's as if I look at that lake differently now when it has this different name. It's being treated as something sacred, whereas it wasn't before. It was a lake just where we went swimming, we went sailing, we went partying when we were teenagers. There were fireworks when, on festival days, skating in the winter. But I never thought about the lake, and I never thought about the people who lived around that lake before it was in the middle of the city where I lived. But by returning to its original name, and even before that name from the Native Americans, it didn't have a name. So, but it's like this translation meditation I give where if I can't even pronounce the name, I have an experience of that lake that I didn't have when I had this concept, Lake Calhoun. And now lake, I don't even know how it's pronounced. It's not even lake, it's like it has its name. Different experience. My concepts have fallen away of what that lake is, and all of my fixed ideas about it have fallen away. It doesn't mean that people don't swim there, that they don't skate there, that they don't sail there. Probably the kids are still partying there, I don't know, It doesn't mean that that has changed. However, when we start looking at it differently as something sacred in the sense that we're giving our attention to it, non-conceptual maybe even. I read recently that at this moment in France, it's something that's called the Printemps des Poètes, which is celebrated in many different ways. It's really a popular celebration of poetry. And I read on one of the signs, it said, I took a picture of it, so I can even remember who said it. It says, so it was Octavio Paz who said it. So it was in Spanish, it was not in French, but here it's in French. La poésie n'est pas incompréhensible. Elle est inexplicable. So poetry is not impossible to understand. It just can't be explained. So we always want to explain poetry. People always say, oh, I don't understand that poetry. I don't understand it. Well, because you're looking to explain it. It's like music. I don't understand classical music, or I don't understand rap, or I don't understand whatever music is you don't understand. It's because you're trying to explain it. And it's not about an explanation. Same thing about a lake or the altar we have, It's incomprehensible, that altar we have. It's a stool with a plastic fake candle with a picture that we grabbed from a stock of pictures at a retreat in Germany that Corinne was giving away, and we cut it to fit into that frame that we bought at Emma and put it there and say this is sacred. Okay, that would be to to like try to understand, well, what is it, where does it come from, or even, well, what's the point? What does it mean? don't need any explanation. We don't need to explain things, okay? Sometimes we do, you know, we have to explain to our children things, or we have to explain how to fill out your tax form, or we do have to explain some things. We hope that the doctor explains to us when he's doing some procedure, or they explain to us at the bank how much they're gonna charge us to borrow money, or whatever it is. Okay. But actually, life, the experience of this moment, cannot be explained. It just can be only lived, and lived fully, I would say, if we're not looking for an explanation for it. And if we can remember this, so when Bodhidharma says vast emptiness, this, we often don't understand what that means, emptiness, right? And again, we can't explain it, because as soon as we explain it, it's no longer that. It just means that we don't make distinctions, that everything is, it actually means fullness, in the sense that the infinite, the vast potential and flourishing of all that is defies our mind, right? Just beyond anything we can explain. And as soon as we start saying, okay, well, this is included in that, but this is not, then we're taking away from that fullness. We're separating things apart. Whereas if we just include it all, we see then the emptiness, in the sense that well, sometimes we define it as we look at, you know, okay, the example of the sun and the shadow. One cannot exist without the other. And so they don't have an independent existence, the sun and the shadow. And actually, if we try to catch that sun and shadow, there's nothing there. If I put my hand there, then I'll create new shadow and new patterns of light. But there's actually nothing there. Or a rainbow is another example. Beautiful rainbows, you know, beautiful, just spectacular. And we're always kind of amazed when it happens. Everyone is. When you see a rainbow, it's everyone is touched by that. Because it defies explanation, even though scientifically we can say, okay, it's just a product of these really transient conditions of humidity, light, at that precise moment, this is what is revealed. And all of color is like that, actually. There's no colors. It's just that our eyes see colors according to the, you know, the way that light and our lenses and our eyes are affected. But it's all transient. It's not fixed. As soon as those conditions fall away or shift, like as soon as the cloud goes in front of the sun, that's no longer there, what we were seeing. Same thing with the rainbows. And part of the reason that we love rainbows are because of that, because of its transient nature, because of its impermanence, and just the sheer beauty of this strange thing that's appeared in the sky. Strange because we don't see it very often. If it was there all the time, we probably wouldn't even think about it. Be like the lake that I swam in as a child. No, I don't even think about it. When things are not there, then we feel them more, you know. Like we say, absence makes the heart feel fonder. In English, we had this phrase. So the reason we appreciate that rainbow is because it's transient, okay? Although we're not really thinking about it. But that's an example of how everything is codependent, interconnected. If there was not that exact condition of light and humidity, and I don't even know all the scientific explanations, but it's a series, it's a whole contingency of things that meet to make that rainbow. The same thing is true of you, yes?
Thunder. What was your saying? The something makes the heart fonder?
Fonder, yeah.
What was the whole thing?
Absence?
Absence.
Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
L'absence rend le cœur plus
chaud,
chaud, apprécie plus.
So the same thing is true of us, okay? It's just this whole contingency of circumstances that have led to us being here right now, in this place, these people, and if you start to try to think about it, it's impossible to get your mind around it. All the things that make so that we are all right here right now. And if you, and then you can like take it apart and look at your own life. So the fact that you are here now, that you are who you are, and you can then look at it in terms of just this physical form and take it apart and bring it down to the lowest common denominator, as we say. And when we get there, we see that, in fact, there's no separation between us because we're all the same thing. And we all have the same nature, is what we say in Buddhism. Not only in Buddhism, but that's, we're talking about this tradition. But, so we are all one in that respect. And that's what, when we talk about emptiness, that's what we're talking about. No individual, no separate personal characteristics. I mean, we manifest in this personal way. That's form, right? That's the world of form. This absolutely distinctive way. But when we take away all of that and we try to break it down, there is no difference. Nothing, it's vast emptiness, and nothing is sacred. If we look at it from the point of view of form, we see that, oh, there's all these different forms manifesting. This is emptiness manifesting as form. We are emptiness. We are the altar. And we're manifesting as this. But it's transient. It's impermanent. It's like that shadow and light on the floor. It's manifesting like that right now, but then it's gone. And the same is true for us. And it's so true that even as, you know, I say this sometimes, like I'm saying this word, it's already gone. It's already different. The air has changed because I said that word. You have changed because of that. Everything has changed. If I don't say a word, it changes. And if you say a word, it changes. Everything is constantly changing and interconnected. So then how can we say something is sacred and something else is not? If it's all connected, it's all moving and happening together. You know, I sometimes tell that story of having one afternoon during a retreat in Montreuil, Donna, really bored, sitting there on my cushion. You know, it was probably a warm summer afternoon or something. I was bored and thinking, what am I going to do all afternoon? You know? So I started thinking of this thing of, it occurred to me, like, how is it that I'm sitting here in this attic of a house in suburban Paris?
Grenier.
Attic.
Okay.
Yeah. of this house in suburban Paris, with, you know, I come from the middle of America, with these people who were from all these various places in Europe, with a teacher who's French. So how is it that I'm sitting here right now? How is it possible that we're all here together right now? You know, how did I get here, or something like that? So, you know, I could very easily trace it back, and how I met her, and how I met them, and how they came here, and how we bought that house, and how we renovated the house, how all this, you know, I could do all this, right? That took a while. And then I started expanding it to, like, okay, so I got here because of this, and I came to France because of that, and I did this, you know, so it's like 2 hours. And then I finally stopped when I got to Napoleon, okay?
Napoleon.
Because I had traced this, I had gone back and back and back and back. And I have an ancestor who was from somewhere in, on my mother's side, an ancestor who was somewhere in what is currently Germany, but it used to be called Prussia, the Prusse.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And someone on my mother's side. And one of these sons of the family was, like, swept up in Napoleon's armies and died in the siege of Moscow. I guess, was it Moscow or Stalingrad? Yeah, it was Moscow, yeah. And died in the siege of Moscow. And the rest of the family said, forget this. We don't want any more of this stuff. We don't want Napoleon. We don't want these wars. Forget it. We're going to the New World, right? So they immigrated to America. Of course, I had ancestors who immigrated long before that. My family has traced first signs of my family in America is 1666,
oh, wow.
Which is a long time ago. Yeah, and then there's traces in England and in Cornwall and whatever. But the whole point being that, so where, how did I get here? You know? How did I get here, but how did any of us get here? And it's not about Napoleon, and it's not about the, you know, the horrors of war, and of really, it's not. And yet, it is, you know, and yet we can trace those things and say, okay, so we can explain it and understand, okay, I know why those people immigrated, and the other people, I don't know why they immigrated, and whatever, you know. But actually, we have this koan of, so what was your face, what was your original face before your parents were born? And this is, you know, this is a hard nut to crack, right? Because we think, well, my original face, and then before my parents were born, well, I didn't have a face before my parents were born. But can we look at it not from trying to understand or explain, but from, okay, so even before the concept of my parents, even before the concept of my face, so we have a really clear idea of what our face looks like. You know, we look at it all the time in the mirror. Right? We don't see it like other people see it, though, which is interesting. Because often, you know, people look at a picture of themselves and they say, oh, that's terrible. And I kind of look at the picture and I think, well, that's not, I mean, it really looks pretty much like the person looks, but we don't see it in that way. And I do the same thing with myself. But so before even the concept of that face, before even that image of my face, before that concept of me, before that concept of my parents, of being born, before all of that, who are you truly? What are you truly? And this is where we join with sacred ground. What is sacred? That's where we find sacred ground. That's where we find the sacred. It's not... We find that it's not a specific place. It's not a specific idea. You know, sometimes when people, sometimes, whenever someone wants to engage with me and say, I want you to be my teacher and whatever. So there's this little ritual that we do. But the only thing that some teachers have, like this whole practically a book of things you have to do to become a student, right? So it's like all these requirements. Some have fewer requirements, but still these, you know, really, you have to do this and this, and you have to follow this class, you have to be here for a certain amount of time or do so many retreats or all this, you know, these stages, these rules and things. Because my experience of the practice is very different than that, and it's very much vast emptiness, nothing sacred. What I require of people is the same thing I require of myself, which is I just require them to give themselves entirely to their life and their practice. And I make that same commitment to them, that my commitment is to give my life and my practice to the, you know, to my best ability to accompanying them on their life and practice. There's nothing else, really. What else could there be, you know? There's not one way to give yourself to live fully. There's not one way to, and even when I say practice, so what is practice? What does that mean? Of course, we have all these koans, we have, you know, rituals, we have retreats like this, we have a Zoom page, we have hours when we do things. Yeah, okay, that is a set of guides that we've put in place to help us experience our life. It sounds crazy that we need this kind of thing to help us experience our life fully. Maybe we don't. You know, Maizumi Roshi, our great ancestor who brought this practice from Japan, used to say, if you don't need to do this practice, don't do it. Or as Rilke said to the young poet in his letters to the young poet, the young poet's asking him, I don't know, you know, should I really give my life to this, to poetry? Should I really do this? I don't know, you know. And Rilke said, if you don't have to do it, don't do it. Which is liberating in a sense. You know, it's like you don't need to have those questions. You know, you can free yourself from those questions and do it if you want to, if you have to, you know, if that's what you really, in this moment, that is what it is for you, do it. But if it's not, don't do it. Don't think you have to do something. That's true practice, actually, when we find our own way and our own place, which is right where you are. Of course, that takes practice to awaken to this. And it doesn't, but it doesn't have to be, there's no set way of deepening our experience of that and deepening our awakening to that. There's no set rule for it. That's why there's so many different, you know, I was sitting there in that office, the kine, the physical therapist's office, just sitting there trying to gather myself a little before giving a Dharma talk. And there was a magazine, a Figaro magazine. What?
You read magazines.
What?
No,
it was just right there. So I looked at it, and on the cover, it was, you know, some author who had, you know, it was like, Sur le chemin de la vie monastique. You know, on the route to, do you know this magazine? It was the Figaro magazine? Or no?
Really?
Yeah. And so it was, you know, on the, this author was writing about, on the road of monastic practice or something. But it was Christian, and So I thought, ooh, this is interesting. So I opened it up just to see what, you know, if there were any, I didn't want to read
ideas.
It, but what?
Ideas for the
No,
talk.
I was just curious, like, what is he doing in the Figaro magazine with this, you know? So I opened it up and thought if there's any of those, what do they call that in French? I don't know. You know, when you have an article and then there's some big type that has been set out, an encadré, I think, or something. To see if there was any big type that had been, you know, some quotes that had, would jump out, you know, and give me an idea of what he was saying. And nothing really did. But there was one thing was something about how, you know, these ancient practices, he was interested in it like between the 5th and the 13th century or something. He was really interested in that, this author. He said these ancient practices that have, you know, continued and continued and continued and are alive even today have meaning for us in our life, in our world today. Even though we think that they don't really. You know, these guys in a monastery somewhere, and it's like, yeah, they don't really have any meaning for us. So if nothing else, you know, the readers of the Figaro magazine see that, you know, and apart from, you know, there's a map of the places he went and everything. So instead of like going as tourists, maybe they will be interested in that, oh, there's something in this that applies to my life today. You know, it's not just in a monastery, but it does apply here and now. So it's really, okay, so I'm sitting there in this, I didn't have to be in a church or in a temple or in a zendo or in a synagogue or in a mosque. I didn't have to be in any special place. I'm sitting in a physiotherapist's office and there's a pile of magazines. And there on that magazine is that, you know, it's everywhere you look. Always. You know, that film from a couple of years ago, everything, everywhere, all at once. I don't know what the title was in French. Does anyone know what it was in French? Everything, everywhere, all at once.
They didn't translate it.
They didn't?
No.
Okay. Interesting, yeah.
You kept the title.
Great title, though, you know? Everything, everywhere, all at once. And that is... That is, you know, is. You could even take away the that is. Could even take away the is. And then we have vast emptiness. But it's pointing to everything, everywhere, all at once. You know, when we arrived and the window was open and there were all the sounds out there. That too is it. That too is sacred. Or the quote that I often cite from James Joyce's Ulysses, where one character is talking, he's a school teacher and he's talking to his headmaster and the boys are outside playing. And they're having this, you know, kind of, the headmaster is really fixed on certain things are sacred and other things aren't. I'm kind of generalizing, but that's the core of the discussion. You know, this is sacred, this is God, this is not. You know, so certain behavior is unacceptable and whatever. And the teacher has a completely different experience of the world. And is, you know, they're having this discussion. And so at one point the headmaster says, well, what is God? Meaning, you know, for you, what is God? And just at that moment, the boys are out playing football or something, and there's a shout, you know, yay, or something. And the character says, a shout in the street. His answer to the question of, well, what is God? A shout in the street. It is. It is. And if we can see that, then we do no harm. How could we do harm then? How could we faire du mal? You know, if we take just this really extreme example of war, and we see this. If we especially pick the war that, you know, is happening on what three of the world's great spiritual traditions consider holy ground, right? And we see what is happening on this holy ground, we see that clearly there is not an experience of vast emptiness, nothing holy. There is clearly fixed ideas about what is holy and what's not, and how holiness, what's sacred and what's not, what can be, how the other is viewed. It's clear. It's so clear. When we see that, because we see the harm that is done when we separate and say certain things are sacred and others aren't, and we can in our hearts feel that if we didn't do that, that, well, then the weapons would be put down and people would be fed and all of their rhetoric would not be exchanged. We know that in our hearts. We can't in our heads see how that can arise in form. It seems just impossible that that can arise. It can. It can. At the moment, it doesn't look like it, but it can. We know that in our hearts. There was a scene in one of these movies, I think it was called Kingdom of Heaven. It was a Ridley Scott film that I saw with my son probably 15 or 20 years ago. Kingdom of Heaven, no one recognizes that. It was about the Crusades. So the Europeans crusading into the Holy Land, trying to take it back from the Sarrazin, you know, the infidels, yeah, right. And so maybe some, Juan, maybe you know that film, Kingdom of Heaven? Yeah, I thought you would. So there's this amazing scene where, I don't think I would have seen this film if it wasn't with my son, but this amazing scene where the fortress of some city or something was occupied by the Christians, the Europeans, and the Sarrazin, was the guy's name Sarrazin or no? No, not Salazar. So, I don't know, forget what his name was. The
Saladin, no, you're close.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. And so they are attacking from across the desert, you know, to take over the fortress. And there's a scene from above, it's filmed from above, pre-drone, I don't know, but filmed from above, and so you see, and there's just this one gate that you can go through, you know, or else you have to in the fortress, or otherwise you have to go over. But there's this one gate, the entrance gate, where everything is concentrated, and there's this from the forces inside and the forces outside, and they're all teeming. I mean, this is this great word in English, teeming, like. Yeah, they're all like, it's like ants, you know, when you look at ants and you're like, what?
Agrégé.
Yeah, I don't know. They're all of these two forces are like, all of these people are just like, when you see it from above, And it's the most absurd thing you've ever seen. These walls that have been built in the middle of the desert, and these people on one side of the wall and people on the other side of the wall, and they're all trying to go through this little door, and they're killing each other to get through this little door, and you can't even see who's who. It's completely lost as it becomes more and more just this like amalgam, you know. Really struck me as a telling image of what we do, you know, of how when we start on the road of this is sacred and this is not, or this is separate, these are good and this is bad, all the separations we create, and we see it like this and we're like, what are we doing? What are we doing? And so when, you know, there's this thing that I heard when I visited Jerusalem of Jesus, you know, Christ over on the Mount of Olives, which is really not very far away, and it's in the middle of Palestinian territory now, looking over the old city, what we now call the old city, seeing this, presumably seeing what Ridley Scott is filming, but of course, seeing the same thing manifested in a different way, right? All of the absurdity and the tragedy of it, you know? And apparently the story is that he wept looking at Jerusalem. This was like the night before he was going to be crucified, but overlooked Jerusalem and said, poor Jerusalem, poor Jerusalem. But that was like poor humanity, poor humanity. Poor us, poor us. What we do to each other when we don't see, when we don't see the oneness, when we don't see that we're one, when we start thinking that certain things are sacred and others aren't. In the places that we designate as sacred, so you think of a church, because we live in Europe and lots of old, beautiful, beautiful churches, the things that humans are capable of doing when they think of something as sacred is amazing. You know, the things that they're capable of doing when they think of something as not sacred is like the flip side of that. So it's absolute sublime beauty. Yeah. Absolutely capable of just these, you know, uplifting, heartfelt manifestations of love and joy and beauty when we think of it as being sacred. When it's not sacred, who cares, you know? Who cares? We can do whatever we want here. So you go into a church and everyone is in agreement pretty much that we go in that church, we don't talk loudly, we move with respect, there's certain things we don't touch, we might sit down and if we pray, we might pray. If we meditate, we might meditate. If we just want to sit there and breathe in and have a break from all the tourists outside in the cool chapel or the cathedral or whatever it is, it's as if we offer ourselves a sacred moment in this sacred space that we've decided is sacred. But can we do that everywhere? Can we treat each space, each place, each chair with that same respect? Of course, it's different. You know, this room is different than the rooms that those people are sitting in on the screen. And yet where they are sitting is sacred. That's their place of meditation. If we were sitting out in a park on the Place de la Bastille, for example, that would be sacred ground. It's sacred even if we're not sitting on it. So let's say it's not sacred because we sit there, but can we open our hearts and our awareness to see that it's all sacred? when we came up out of the metro. So I come out of the metro all the time here. It's usually at night. But, you know, I've lived in Paris for so long, and I come up that metro in, at the Bastille regularly. I used to live in this neighborhood. However, I am of a generation where it's still kind of new, the Opéra Bastille. It's not new. It's not new. It was built in the 80s, but it's still, I still kind of think of it as new, and this exit from the metro up the steps from under the opera is still kind of new. It's not. So we come up this, and it's this, you know, fabulous, like this, you know, suddenly the fabulous, beautiful morning light, you know, clear sky, and I'm with Daniel. And Daniel comes up, and he's probably never come up that step before, you know. And because he expressed seeing it, and expressed seeing it for the first time, I could see it for the first time. I could let go of my usual experience of it. And can I say what you said when we came up? Or do you want to say it?
Sure. You mean about the creatures?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I came up and I said, it's like Paris is built for creatures that are bigger than us.
Yeah. It was really beautiful to, it, you know, beyond us, you know? And that...
Parce que qu'est-ce que vous avez vu en haut de l'escalier? Moi, c'est juste ça que je vais comprendre.
Bah, quand on monte de l'escalier sous l'opéra, soudain, on monte, c'est assez direct et c'est large, et on monte, et c'était le ciel bleu magnifique, l'obélisque au milieu,
voilà, c'est
doré, le génie de Bastille. Can we experience as it's larger than us? You know? Vast emptiness, and the fact that, you know, it's interesting, the fact that I'm you know, riffing off of what Daniel said, but the fact that there are these buildings and that obelisk and that what we call the Génie de la Bastille, that gold thing on the top, and then the facade of this modern opera on this side, that it's like, you know, the window frames that and the clouds that give a certain play of light. There's a certain experience of the space because of all that. It was the same sky and the same sun in Montreuil when we got in the metro. The sun was maybe not as bright. It was a different situation, different circumstances. And all of you, the same thing, you know, we were all under the same sky. In the same sunlight. We were all sitting in the same room. And this is the same, this space is, that's outside and this is inside, but it's not actually. It's all one space. It's all one vast emptiness. Yeah, I'm gonna keep in my own time. Yeah.
It's one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, in this vast emptiness, we have things that we call time. We have hours, we have minutes, we have schedules, and we respect them. It's all sacred, so we will stop now. I'm sorry, I didn't give it to you. If anyone wants to add something briefly or ask a question, we can do that. Daniel, yeah?
You said that Mizumi said, if you don't feel like you have to do it, don't do it.
Yeah.
So I'm imagining that you on your own, I mean, in your, on your path, you had the sense that you had to do it. But can you say what that means for you? Like, what did you to, yeah.
Yeah, good question. So did you hear this on the, you could hear that question? Okay. So the, yeah, have is really not a great verb. We could also say want, maybe. Need, maybe, I don't know. So for me, having, you know, outside of all of this, had a deep experience of what I'm talking about. You know, of the things as they are and whatever it is. It just became so clear to me that this of sitting, what someone told me was meditation. I didn't know this was meditation. That's what meditation was. But then someone put a name on it, and I said, "Oh, that's meditation." It's like when I was a little child, and I used to hear people talk about headaches. And I never really knew what a headache was until at one point I thought, so is what I'm feeling, is this what a headache is? No, it's like you have an experience of something, but you don't know what the name's of, you know? You don't know what that is. So I didn't know this was meditation, but then somebody told me it was. And it's not that I had to, but it was like, this was my life. This is what, there was nothing else that had meaning as much as this, you know? In fact, this is what helped me to know what life is, something like that. And it wasn't necessarily Zen practice, but I did know, because I was alone, I did know that I wanted someone else, I wanted to share it with other people, and I wanted somebody to give me some guidance. And it just so happened that the person I met who gave me advice, could give me some guidance, did this. And I knew that I wanted some kind of structure for to pour myself into, something like that. So it's not like have to because there's a rule. It was more like wanting, you know. I really, really wanted to do this. Not because I wanted to obtain something, but because that's already what I was or something. I wanted what I was, maybe. Okay. Yep.
Very short.
Okay.
I have to say something very important. The genius, Labastide, is seven meters high.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Nine, okay, because you all think that he's small, but he's like, I was there once, I went to
the actual genie on the top?
Yeah,
oh.
Just a genius, he's seven
okay.
meters high, so that's why it's like impressive.
So, I don't know if you could hear that, but on the top of the in the middle of the Bastille Square, which is near where we are here in Paris, there's a big obelisk, and on a column, yeah, like, and on the top of it, there's this golden statue, which is called the Génie de la Bastille. And Claudia just tells us, from down on the ground, it looks like it's quite small. Claudia tells us that it's 7 meters high. So this gold thing at the top is 7 meters high. So these are, you know, measurements and things, and which are very impressive to hear and understand, whatever. And yet our experience of it is not that, you know? Which is really interesting. Okay, I think we've gone beyond time. Thank you. Have a wonderful day there in Lisbon together and alone and near Lisbon alone. And Mikhail, I forget where you live. yeah, okay. And we'll be online still if you want to connect.
We're back at 3.
Yeah, we'll be back at 3 Paris time. 15h. Oui. Thank you.